sedentary habits, will quickly and dramatically fall ill. Nowhere is this more obvious than in the Pacific Islands. Once so admired for their beautiful bodies and health that the first explorers thought they had stumbled upon Eden, their descendants are now the most obese people on the face of the earth. Having traded in their traditional diet of yam, coconuts, fruits, and fish for deadly modern processed foods, the health of these islanders has plummeted. In some places, up to 90% of the population is overweight, and half the population, perhaps more, is obese. In a truly terrifying statistic, 40% of the Pacific Island population has been diagnosed with a non-communicable disease, such as diabetes, heart disease, or hypertension. These diseases account for 75% of the deaths in the region. And while the inhabitants of the Pacific Islands provide the most drastic example of the modern health epidemic, they certainly aren't the only ones suffering. Obesity-related illnesses kill over 8,000 people every single day. The lack of public outcry over this is bewildering. Maybe it's because everyone's mouths are too filled with fudge brownies to say anything. The health consequences of obesity are disastrous. They include, but are not limited to, heart disease, cancer, asthma, stroke, dementia, type 2 diabetes, and birth defects. Worldwide, obesity is the leading cause of death, and it is totally preventable. The saddest of all is childhood obesity, which has doubled over the last 30 years, and quadrupled among adolescents. By 2012, one-third of all children were overweight or obese. The consequences to the health of our children have been devastating. Kids are now suffering from all sorts of cancers, hypertension, and other heart problems that previous generations didn't think were possible. Type 2 diabetes used to be called adult-onset diabetes because it was something that only occurred once you were fully grown. Now, children get it. An obese child is far more likely to become an obese adult than a thin child. Even if an obese child grows up and makes every effort to lose weight, the effects of being obese as a child will still linger, as the body never fully recovers. Allowing your kids to become fat and thereby permanently damaging their health is child abuse, plain and simple. The toll of obesity doesn't simply affect the overweight. The latest estimates are that obesity could cost up to $344 billion per year in the United States alone by 2018. That's a lot of money that thin people are being forced to cough up in the form of taxes and increased insurance premiums. A concerted effort is needed by all of us to tackle this problem, and it begins with education. There is a popular misconception that obesity is determined by genetics, and hence, a fatalist acceptance of an oval-shaped physique. While genetics plays a role in everything, with the rare exception of certain diseases, it is no one's destiny to be obese. In the year 1900, only 1 in 150 people were obese. Now, 35% of Americans over the age of 20 are obese, and the number is skyrocketing. The problem is environmental, not genetic.
The human genome has not undergone such dramatic change in only a few generations that we now look like a completely different animal.
When scientists looked at the body composition of the hunter-gatherer Hadza tribe of Tanzania, they did not find a single member of the tribe to be overweight. The fattest person in the entire community was a woman with a BMI of 23.9, while the CDC's criteria for overweight is 25. The mean age of women in the tribe was 40, and yet the average BMI for a Hadza woman was a slim 20.2, with a body fat percentage of 20.9%. By comparison, the average body fat percentage for women in Western society is 37%. The Hadza men came in at a lean 20.3 BMI and 13% body fat. The Hadza are not outliers. Getting fat is just not something HGs do or did beyond the rare occasion of bulking up before a foreseen famine. Human beings are not meant to be fat. not as children, not as adults, and not in our golden years. What exactly is the problem? Why is modern processed food so bad for us, while traditional diets are healthy? For the same reason a cow can survive on grass and we can't. There are foods that we are meant to eat, and there are foods we are not. The philosophy of the paleo diet is that humans are genetically adapted to the diet of our Paleolithic ancestors. For 2 million years, human beings roamed the planet in search of wild fruits and vegetables while hunting game meats. It was only the advent of agriculture that cereal grains, dairy, refined sugars, refined cooking oils, and alcohol became staples of the modern diet. In fact, 70% of the total energy consumed by citizens of the United States comes from these new energy sources. This massive divergence from our ancestral diet to the modern diet of processed foods is the reason for the skyrocketing rates of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and some forms of cancer. Sounds like a solid theory, but is it backed up by science? Yes, it is. Observational evidence. Luckily for us, there are people alive today that remain uninfluenced by the trappings of the modern food industry. They are hard to find, but they are out there. One population of such people lives on the island of Kitava, off the coast of Papua New Guinea. The Kitavans eat a diet of root vegetables, fruits, coconuts, leafy vegetables, and fish. Dr. Staffan Lindberg and his colleagues studied the Kitavans to ascertain their levels of health. They were found to have no incidence of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, or even acne. The elderly showed no signs of dementia or memory loss. A meta-analysis of the health profile of modern-day hunter-gatherer civilizations, including the Bushmen of Africa, the Yanomamo and Xingu tribes of the Amazon, and the Kitavans, found these tribal societies to have 1. Lower blood pressure. 2. No association between blood pressure and age. 3. Persistent, excellent insulin sensitivity. 4. Lower body mass, no incidences of people being overweight or obese. 5. Lower waist-to-height ratios. 6. Greater maximum oxygen consumption. 7. Better vision. 8. Better bone health, among others. Diet and mental health. In recent years, numerous studies have demonstrated the effect of diet on mental health. In 2011, a study of over 5,000 Norwegians revealed that those who ate a traditional diet of meat and vegetables had lower levels of anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder compared to those who ate either a modern Western diet of processed and fast foods or a group of people eating a so-called healthy vegetarian diet of salads and tofu. The relationship between diet and brain chemistry is incredibly complex. What follows is a simplified explanation of what goes on in your brain and an analysis of the chemicals responsible for certain moods. The human brain contains about 100 billion neurons or nerve cells. These cells communicate with each other through chemical and electrical signals. The process by which they do this is by sending neurotransmitters from one neuron to another across the synapse, a small gap between neurons. These neurotransmitters are chemical messengers that carry information from one neuron to the next. Many types of neurotransmitters exist, but for your well-being, the most essential are dopamine and serotonin. Dopamine is the brain's reward system. Your body will release a surge of dopamine when you anticipate a rewarding behavior, such as sex and eating. In lab studies, mice that were depleted of dopamine could not be motivated to find food that was close by and would starve to death without the intervention of the experimenters. Dopamine drives behavior to accomplish goals. If you are low on dopamine, you might feel lethargic, have trouble concentrating, and generally feel unmotivated. People with ADHD are treated with drugs that activate dopamine systems in the brain.
Drugs like cocaine and meth have similar effects on the dopamine system. In these drugs, overactivation of the dopamine system can lead to long-term depletion of dopamine receptors. Sugary, processed foods work much the same way. A 2001 study published in The Lancet showed that obese people have fewer dopamine receptors than people of normal weight, and that the fattest people had even fewer dopamine receptors than their less obese but still corpulent cohorts. When it comes to well-being, serotonin is the most famous chemical. The most commonly prescribed drugs for depression, such as Prozac and Paxil, are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. These drugs are thought to work by blocking the reabsorption of serotonin in the sending nerve cell. When one nerve cell sends information to the next, and that cell is using serotonin as its chemical messenger, the serotonin crosses over the synapse from the sending neuron to the receiving neuron, delivers its message, and then can return to the sending neuron. Back in the sending neuron, the serotonin is in position to act as a messenger again for the next nerve signal. Those with depression may have low levels of serotonin, and the serotonin that they do have may be reabsorbed too soon. As a result, the communication between the brain cells is impaired. What an SSRI does is block the reabsorption of serotonin, leaving more serotonin in the synapse. When the amount of serotonin in the synapse is sufficient, communication between nerve cells will improve, and depression may be alleviated. Serotonin is also thought to improve sleep, as well as reduce anxiety and irritability. If your serotonin levels are low, you can take an SSRI, which is basically a Band-Aid, and only works for some people. Or you can figure out why your serotonin levels are low in the first place, and fix the problem by solving the root cause. Many factors influence low serotonin levels, but here we are interested only in diet-related causes. One of the major building blocks of serotonin is the amino acid tryptophan. If you don't get enough tryptophan in your diet, there is reduced synthesis of serotonin in the brain. But it is not as simple as just adding tryptophan. Tryptophan needs vitamin B6 to make serotonin, so you need more of that vitamin as well. Because these chemicals work in concert, it is better to get them from whole foods than taking supplements. Sea lion kidney holds the record for the food with the highest content of tryptophan. If you know of a good supplier of that, pass it on to me. Otherwise, you can eat more conventional foods such as spinach, crab, lobster, fish, pork, goat, and eggs. Vitamin B6 is one of the most common deficiencies for people who eat the Western diet. However, it is easily obtained by eating tuna, turkey, beef, chicken, salmon, sweet potatoes, spinach, and bananas. Inadequate levels of magnesium are also thought to reduce the amount of serotonin in the brain. One study showed that in diabetic patients, treating them with magnesium was just as effective as antidepressants in treating depression. Green leafy vegetables such as spinach and Swiss chard, as well as pumpkin and sesame seeds, are the best bet for getting magnesium through your diet. Gut bacteria. In 2009, a remote tribe of Yanomami Indians were going about their daily lives of hunting and gathering in the mountainous region of the Amazon, just as they had been for thousands of years, when a team of microbiologists from the NYU School of Medicine and the Venezuelan government suddenly appeared. The Indians knew that the outside world existed and had invented words to describe the airplanes they saw fly overhead, but they had never been contacted by modern people before. Now, here they were, these other humans with their magical flying machines right there in the Yanomami village. What could they possibly want? Poop, apparently. The microbiologists said hello, asked if they could have a few samples of Yanomami droppings, climbed back into their helicopters, and vanished. Hippocrates said that all disease begins in the gut. Now, over 2,000 years later, we are just beginning to understand the importance of the microbiome, the 100 trillion bacteria that make their home in the human body. A Western diet full of processed foods and sugar negatively alters the balance between good and bad bacteria. Hunter-gatherers don't have this problem. Their digestive tracts are flourishing with all sorts of microbes helpful in immune function, digesting carbohydrates, and acting as prebiotics, to name just a few of the benefits. The Yanomami were found to have 50% more ecological diversity than the average American. The modern diet is one cause of our famished microbiome, but our cleanliness is another. There is a trade-off here. HGs live outside nearly 24/7, have few scruples about eating certain animal parts raw, drink from streams, and don't use soap. Many scientists feel that our sterility is the cause of overactive immune responses such as allergies. With nothing else to do, our immune response goes on red alert in the presence of benign invaders like tree pollen. Studies of infants found that those with less diverse gut bacteria were more likely to have food allergies to milk, peanuts, and eggs. Lower levels of certain types of gut bacteria have even been linked to autism. On the other hand, our purified drinking water and hand washing habits ensure that we don't die from intestinal parasites. How can we safely improve our gut bacteria? We can eat lots of fruits, vegetables, and fermented foods like sauerkraut. The more adventurous can get a fecal matter transplant. Think I'm joking? Anthropologists working with the Hadza tribe have been taking samples of the tribesmen's dung and then inserting the feces into their own rectums using a turkey baster. Now, with that attractive image clearly in your mind, let me tell you what you should be eating. Good to eat. Fish, preferably wild-caught. Other seafood. Beef, preferably grass-fed beef. Poultry. Pig. Other game meats. Vegetables. Root vegetables. Fruits. Nuts. Seeds. Eggs. Foods to avoid. Processed foods. Grains. Refined sugar, processed oils. Gray area foods. Depends on individual variation. Eliminate these foods from your diet at first, and then slowly let them back in and see how they affect you. Dairy, if you are not lactose intolerant, should be whole fat and better if fermented, such as cheeses and yogurts. Rice. Potatoes. Modern potatoes differ significantly from their wild tuber counterparts. Most paleo diet gurus recommend sweet potatoes instead. Personally, I'll eat any type of baked potato. Yum. Fun fitness. The hunt will begin at 8 a.m. once everyone has woken up, had a smoke, and sharpened their arrows. When you live under the remorseless Tanzanian sun, it is best to catch your breakfast before the afternoon heat sets in. Around the campfire, the men chat about where they are going, what they will hunt, and hopefully kill. Some will go together in search of wild honey. They will build a fire to distract the bees with smoke, and then stick their bare hands inside the tree and pull out the delicious treat. Others will hunt alone. The Hadza have no leaders, and even boys are allowed to go off with bows and arrows in hand wherever their whim takes them. How far they will travel depends on how fast they find prey. The average Hadza walks 5 miles a day, but on days where food is hard to find, it is not unheard of to tread through the bush for 15 to 20 miles. There are no electric outlets in the red clay near their camp to plug in a refrigerator. If you want to eat, you have to go out and get it. Here's a dirty little secret about exercise. It's unnatural. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't do it. What do I mean? Haven't I already explained that our ancestors looked smashingly fit? The issue is one of semantics. The dictionary definition of exercise being activity requiring physical effort, carried out especially to sustain or improve health and fitness, Our ancestors were very active and burned lots of calories, but they did all this hunting, gathering, logging buckets of water, and chopping wood, not to improve their physical fitness, but in the service of another goal, survival. An HG didn't go for a jog to improve his triathlon time. He and his companions jogged for hours hunting large game. Women didn't do squats to make their butts look nice. They did squats while picking up a basket of sweet potatoes. It would be crazy for an HG to waste precious energy exercising when food sources were limited, and muscle soreness might hinder his ability to walk 20 kilometers the next day while carrying a carcass on his shoulders. Despite never going to the gym, the average daily physical activity level of the HG was far greater and much more varied than that of your typical Westerner. The daily movement of an HG might go as follows. Men would pick up their bows and arrows, walk miles through the tough terrain of the jungle or bush, ducking under branches, hopping over streams, until they found the animal they were hunting. Upon encountering the beast, there could be an intense chase, requiring all-out sprinting. Once the creature was subdued, the HG would carry it back to camp. There, the animal would be skinned and chopped up. Women would also go on long walks to areas where vegetables grew. They would dig up the plants and carry the heavy baskets back, often with a young child strapped to their torsos. Besides acquiring food, HGs had to engage in the maintenance activities of life, weaving baskets, sharpening blades, chopping and carrying firewood, making clothing, and building huts. At night, they might dance for hours. They were the original cross-trainers, and it showed in their slim, fit bodies. This physical exertion is not only necessary for sexy midsections, but for mental health as well. A study conducted by Duke University took clinically depressed patients and put them into two different treatment groups. One group took the antidepressant medication Zoloft, and the other group simply engaged in brisk walking 3 times a week for 30 minutes. After 4 months, both the Zoloft group and the walking group had significantly improved their depression compared to those taking a placebo. However, in a 6-month follow-up, those who had taken Zoloft were 3 times more likely to have their depression return than those who were exercising. Merely walking is a better treatment for depression than the best chemical products our genius scientists can come up with. More vigorous exercise is even better. A review study on the effects of exercise on mental health found that exercising is a robust treatment for psychological conditions ranging from anxiety disorders to schizophrenia. Conversely, the lack of exercise is associated with the development of these very same disorders. Even if you aren't suffering from a classically defined mental illness, exercising is imperative to boosting mood, enhancing attention span, and improving cognitive ability. Science has disproven the dumb jock stereotype. It's the kids who exercise that have the highest mental functioning, and adults who maintain physical fitness are far more likely to age gracefully, both in terms of appearance and mental ability. A female friend once spoke to me about her dilemma. She needed to get in shape, but she hated exercise. This is a common complaint among today's more sedentary types. They whine that exercising is painful, a chore, something they don't find enjoyable. I asked my friend what she did for exercise. "Oh, I get on the treadmill and jog for 45 minutes. It's so boring. I hate it." "You're right," I told her. "That's a terrible way to exercise. Running on a treadmill is monotonous. It doesn't engage the total body, and it is a joyless, solitary endeavor." All of which would have been completely foreign to how her female ancestors moved. While men in HG tribes might hunt alone, the women gathered together in groups for safety reasons. A female human being is a large, powerful ape in her own right, and a group of them is enough to deter predatory animals from viewing them as an easy lunch. Using our ancestors as a guide, women should work out with other females, and the exercises should be varied and involve not only aerobic conditioning, but also weightlifting. Group classes at the gym can be great for this, but keep it diverse. Don't just do spin, don't just do yoga, do both, and add some weights as well. Dancing, from Zumba to Tango, mimics the hours our grandest of grandmothers spent twirling and jiving around the campfire. Humans also have an innate need to compete, especially men. Our ancestors exerted physical effort with a goal of defeating an opponent, sometimes alone, but generally as part of a team. Sometimes this opponent was an animal, sometimes an enemy in war. Men like to win battles. Thus, sports, both team and individual, are the most psychologically rewarding forms of exercise for fellas. If we can do this outside, under the shining sun, even better. It's also essential for us to keep our activities varied. By doing so, we will master the four cornerstones of fitness and athleticism: having great cardio, being strong, being flexible, and being skilled. Go for a long hike with a group of friends, or grab 2 50-pound sandbags, hand one to a buddy, and see who can walk a mile the fastest. Take a hot yoga class. Play basketball. Learning a martial art can satisfy that innate desire to be a warrior and protector. No matter who you are, if exercise isn't fun, you are either doing it wrong or your attitude needs work. When we are lifting weights, our muscles require extra oxygen and nutrients. To accomplish this, the body sends a rush of blood to the muscle. Bodybuilders call this the pump. Arnold Schwarzenegger described the feeling as follows: "The greatest feeling you can get in a gym, or the most satisfying feeling you can get in the gym, is the pump. Let's say you train your biceps. Blood is rushing into your muscles, and that's what we call the pump. Your muscles get a really tight feeling, like your skin is going to explode any minute, and it's really tight. It's like somebody blowing air into it, into your muscle. It just blows up, and it feels really different. It feels fantastic. It's as satisfying to me as, coming is, you know? As, having sex with a woman and coming. And so you can believe how much I am in heaven. I am like, getting the feeling of coming in a gym. I'm getting the feeling of coming at home. I'm getting the feeling of coming backstage when I pump up. When I pose in front of 5,000 people, I get the same feeling. So I am coming day and night. I mean, it's terrific, right? So you know, I'm in heaven." Get up, stand up, stand up for your life. Even if you exercise, sitting will still kill you. All that vigorous training you do isn't enough to offset the 9.3 hours we spend each day on our rumps. Modern life is one long, rarely interrupted sitting session from the moment we wake up to the moment we turn in for the night. We eat breakfast while sitting down in our kitchen. Then we sit in our cars until we get to work, where we spend the next 8 hours mostly sitting in front of a computer. And when it's time to leave, we get back in our cars and back to the dinner table before finally plopping down on the couch for some primetime television. Studies indicate that prolonged sitting will take as many years off your life as smoking. One provocative finding published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine found that after age 25, every hour you sit in front of the television takes 22 minutes off your life expectancy. Deep down inside, we know that all this lethargy isn't good for us. Mom has been yelling at us not to be a couch potato since we were tots. But what exactly goes wrong in the body while we are sitting? Let's start with the heart. During a prolonged sit, blood flows sluggishly and can clog the heart with the fatty acids that your muscles aren't burning. Those of us who sit the most have higher blood pressure, higher cholesterol levels, and a far higher chance of dying from a heart attack. Another problem caused by sitting is an enormous increase in our risk of getting diabetes. When we sit, our plasma insulin and glucose levels rise, since our idle muscle cells don't respond as effectively to insulin. Some scientists theorize that the excess insulin in our system is also the reason that sitting has been linked to colon, breast, and other cancers. Furthermore, sitting can lead to muscle degeneration. Slumped in a chair, our core and leg muscles aren't getting used, which can cause a host of other muscular problems downstream as we try to compensate for these flabby muscles. We also become inflexible in our necks, our spines, and especially our all-important hip flexors. Most important as regards to our mental health, prolonged sitting leads to brain fog. When we are up and moving, blood flows through the body and into the brain, causing a release of alertness and feel-good chemicals. Nietzsche, ahead of his time as always, once quipped, "All great thoughts are conceived by walking." To combat the effects of sitting, you need to get up and move around every 30 minutes. Take a little walk around the building, go up and down a few stairs, throw a few kicks and punches when no one's looking. In one study, people who simply walked for 2 minutes after every hour of sitting lowered their risk of premature death by 33%. Posture. There are indigenous cultures that report essentially no back pain, the result of the natural ways in which they hold their bodies. When studying the spinal cords of these indigenous people, we notice something different than what our modern anatomy books tell us about the shape of the spine. Their spines are J-shaped instead of the modern American S-shape. The S-shape refers to modern man's tendency to slump forward, with the shoulders drooped and the neck sticking out in front of the back. This isn't natural. Instead, it's a result of poor posture humans have recently adopted. Our ancestors didn't sit in chairs with backrests. When they sat, they did so on rocks, logs, and tree stumps, or just on the ground with their legs crossed. Often, they simply did a full squat and rested in that pose. Indigenous cultures, and even Leonardo da Vinci drawings, show a spine that is straight all the way down to the base before it curves to make the buttocks stick out. Remarkably, sitting up straight influences what we remember. In one experiment at San Francisco State University, students who were told to sit with good posture found it easier to recall positive memories from time past. Poor posture has the opposite effect. When experimenters had participants walk around slouched over, they found that their mood darkened and their energy levels waned. Another group, told to skip, saw their energy levels increase. You might want to be discreet about using this tip at the office. Bob, what's that you're doing in there? Is that skipping? Sure is, Phil. Keeps my energy levels up. Constantly reminding yourself to stand up straight may help, but what you really need to do is stretches and exercises that will align the muscles and take care of any imbalances. The fastest and easiest exercise to correct for your slumped over shoulders is to simply hang from a pull-up bar. Try to hang for 30 seconds at first, and then work your way up to longer times. Do this in the morning, and you'll be walking around tall and proud all day long. Next, you need to straighten your pelvis. Because of prolonged sitting, we tend to stand with the front of our pelvis leaning downwards, and the back of our pelvis raised. This causes a cascade of problems up and down the spine. To correct for this, lie down on your back and put your feet up on a chair so that your thighs and torso are at a 90-degree angle, as well as another 90-degree angle between your shins and thighs. Place your hands about 8 inches away from your body, with your palms facing the ceiling. Tuck in your chin a bit so that your neck isn't arched. This position will align our pelvic muscles, which the heels on our shoes cause to lean downwards, creating a chain reaction of spinal curvature all the way up through our necks. Just lay there for 5 minutes or so. I personally like to do breathing exercises or meditation while I'm in this position, killing 2 birds with 1 stone. You can also make use of the time by listening to relaxing music or a book on tape. Try it. You'll like it. Day and night. As I open my eyes to the rising summer sun, I have a ritual I do the first thing in the morning. Before making breakfast, before checking my phone and my email and getting on with the chores of the day, I get out of bed and pick up my yoga mat. I walk outside to my back deck, lay the mat on the ground, and begin a series of yoga postures called sun salutations. Stretching my limbs as the sun's rays beat upon my bare back, I feel energized. I am soaking up the awesome power from our nearest star. My muscles begin to loosen, my body calms down, and my mind feels alert and calm. The tone for the rest of the day has been set. Today, we spend far too much time indoors. For the average American, at least 87% of the day. Considering that our ancestors spent nearly all their time outdoors, this marks quite a rupture with ancient life. This disconnect is absolutely terrible for our health and happiness. A half billion years ago, our microscopic ancestors began to develop a circadian rhythm, the tone of their life, setting and rising with the spin of the Earth's axis to the glow of the sun's rays. We evolved chemical processes regulating our ability to function well in accordance with these astronomical facts. Exposure to the sun tells the brain to produce serotonin, helping us to be more focused and happy. Get your daily dose first thing in the morning, and you are going to have a nice start to the day. Later, as the sun dips down below the horizon, our bodies anticipate the oncoming slumber, gradually lowering the core body temperature, releasing melatonin and the neurotransmitter adenosine, and easing us into a beautiful sleep. Modern life fails to honor the precious relationship with that astonishing yellow star, disrupting the natural balance in our lives by replacing sunlight with artificial bulbs, the great outdoors with a four-walled room, and the relaxing glow of the campfire before bedtime with hyper-stimulating TV, PC, cell phone, and iPad screens. Our biological processes get thrown into disorder, leading to a society of fat, sickly, walking zombies desperately clutching their cappuccinos like Gollum's ring. Vitamin D. My body is well adapted to the warm and sunny Mediterranean environment where my forefathers spent their days outside hunting and gathering and eventually farming. Despite my attempts to get as much sunlight as possible, the cold winters and cultural mores of the society which I now inhabit force me to cover my skin in clothing and spend far too much time indoors. My vitamin D levels plummet to unsafe levels, and I must resort to taking supplements, which are helpful but cannot completely compensate for the lack of those missing, shining rays. When the sun does appear in all its glory during those frosty months, it beckons me like the sirens of yore. Come, Javon, never mind the chill air. Take off your shirt, lay out, and let my brilliant golden beams warm your body. And I acquiesce. Recent studies show that worldwide, over 1 billion people are vitamin D deficient, and if you live in a northern climate, above Philadelphia, the odds are better than 50-50 that you are one of these folks. If you have dark skin, you are particularly susceptible. This is no small matter. Vitamin D deficiency increases the risk of bone diseases like osteoporosis, as well as heart disease, stroke, multiple sclerosis, depression, and impacts the strength of your immune system, making it more likely that you will catch an infection. A study of Japanese children found that those who took a 1200 IU pill of vitamin D daily were 40% less likely to catch the flu that year than a placebo group. In the elderly, those with low vitamin D levels are far more likely to suffer from impaired understanding, dementia, and Alzheimer's. Skeptic. But wait a minute. If I spend all that time in the sun, am I not susceptible to skin cancer? Answer. Skin cancer is indeed a risk for those who spend too much time in the sun, particularly those of lighter complexion. Their genes evolved to accommodate the gloomy, overcast lands of Northern Europe, not the scalding beaches of Florida, which turns their skin into a leathery crisp. How to know if you are getting too much sun? Well, your skin evolved a great mechanism for such detection. It burns. Get as much sun as you can, but stop before you turn into a lobster. The cancer risk of not getting enough sunlight might outweigh that of getting too much. Vitamin D has a protective effect against colon, breast, prostate, and ovarian cancers. Sleep. As the sun fell and darkness descended on the ancestral world, the lack of artificial light cued the body that sleep was not far away. These long periods of darkness, 12 hours a day on average, meant there was plenty of time for slumber parties. And that is exactly what our ancestors did. Families slept together in a single hut. The whole tribe might pass out together in one large dwelling or by the fire. Anthropological reports of modern tribes show that some people do not fall asleep for 8 hours straight, but awaken at different points in the night, make love, laugh, stoke the fire, and then go back to sleep. At any point in the night, there is usually someone in the tribe who is awake. These habits are a carryover from our simian days, when dangerous predators lurked in the darkness. Some recent sleep studies of hunter-gatherers challenge this view and report that the tribe slept steadily throughout the night and did not awaken for substantial periods of time, instead dozing the whole night through. Whatever the case, our ancestors slept well. Two of the tribes whose sleep habits have been most thoroughly examined by scientists, the Chimene of Bolivia and the San of Namibia, have no word in their language that corresponds to insomnia. Only 2% of the members of these tribes report having trouble sleeping more than one night a year. There might not be anything more important to your mental well-being than getting consistent, high-quality sleep. After a bad night's sleep, our whole operating system runs inefficiently. We can't pay attention, we don't encode what we learned that day into long-term memory, we are quicker to feel irritated and angry, more prone to mood swings, more likely to make poor decisions. Prolonged sleep deprivation has been linked to anxiety, depression, and even suicide. Sleep is just as important for physical health. During the night, our body repairs any injured tissues, regulates hormones, adjusts insulin levels, and keeps our heart and blood vessels functioning properly. Obesity, heart attacks, stroke, and diabetes are all linked to sleep deprivation. Our immune system is similarly impaired, making us more likely to catch a cold from the slob coughing into his hands and then touching a public doorknob. When we are tired, any lingering infections we have just won't seem to go away. We don't have to miss major amounts of sleep for any of this to occur either. Just an hour or two of missed sleep for a few days in a row, and these deleterious effects will show up. You have to make sleep a top priority in your life. You should wake up feeling refreshed and energetic after a night of quality sleep. If you feel like you are dragging yourself through the mud until you have your coffee, you aren't getting quality sleep. Here are a few tips for improved sleep. Avoid stimulation. Limit your intake of caffeine to the morning. Consumption in the afternoon and evening is going to impact your sleep. That includes not only coffee and energy drinks, but also tea and chocolate. Blue light from computer, television, and phone screens tricks our body into thinking it is still bright out and delays the onset of melatonin. For my single friends, the late hours of the night can be a time of intense sexual arousal and intense loneliness. It is in these moments that the lure of dating apps and erotic websites reaches its zenith. Even if we manage to fall asleep just after a tiny amount of stimulus, the quality of our sleep will be compromised. Alcohol is a depressant that makes it easier to pass out, but it affects the quality of sleep, especially if you drink too much or drink within a few hours of bedtime. I am well aware that advising young adults to limit alcohol intake before bedtime is impossible on weekends. For college students, it seems to be impossible any day of the week. But the facts don't lie. If you don't sleep, you don't prosper. Dark room. ever been camping deep in the woods, far away from civilization where the glare of the nearest city's lights can't reach you? It's pitch black, as I once learned with some indignity. Having to wake in the middle of the night to relieve myself of the copious amounts of hard cider I had consumed around the campfire, I hazily stumbled out of my tent into the darkness, fumbling with my belt buckle as I stepped off a small ledge and landed face down in the dirt below. That's how black your room should be at night. No uncovered windows capturing streetlight, no computer screens on, no light coming from the hallway, not even little LED lights from charging plugs. Even with your eyes closed, the smallest light on your skin will disrupt the release of melatonin from your pineal gland and affect the deepness of your sleep. If you can still see your hands in front of your face, your room isn't dark enough. Cool. Research says that the optimal sleeping temperature for most people is between 60 and 70 degrees. I would add a little nuance to this and say that the right temperature also has to do with a variance in heat between day and night. Our genes are programmed to sleep at temperatures cooler than those we experience during the day. You are probably at least subconsciously aware of this, setting your thermostat to a higher temperature in the summer than in the winter. In the African savanna of our pre-clothing evolution, where we slept naked and without covers, nighttime temperatures fell to 68 during the dry season and only to 78 during the rainy season. Nowadays, most of us wear at least some clothing while we sleep, use blankets, and have probably made some adaptation to sleeping in the even colder climates of Europe and Asia or wherever we happen to be from. Between 60 and 70 degrees, then, seems a good bet. Just keep that in mind as you program your thermostat to lower the temperature in the evening below your daytime level. A little nighttime chill will signal to your body that it is time to pass out. Sanctuary. So much of sleep has to do with subconscious signals learned from habit. It is important that when you lie down, your body takes this as a cue to pass out. Do not lay in bed to read, watch TV shows, or send emails. Your bed should be a place where only two activities occur. You know what they are. If you can dedicate your entire bedroom to nothing other than a good night's rest, even better. Keep your computer and television somewhere else in the house, and your bedroom a simple, uncluttered sanctuary that you enter and leave at regular times. Stress. Once you have the external conditions for quality sleep all set up, the key is to never worry about sleep. Lying in bed, tossing and turning, feeding your mind negative thoughts like, "I read that if I don't get 8 hours of sleep, I won't be able to function," will only exacerbate your problem. The irony is that if you want great sleep, you can't worry about getting great sleep. Help your mind to relax by taking it easy in the hours before bed. Avoid social media, particularly any news stories that might rile you up. Stay away from exciting television shows. And most important of all, avoid any interpersonal dispute. This is a time to read a book, meditate, listen to a podcast, or cuddle with significant others. It is a time to wind down. Get out in nature. Growing up in the suburbs, I dreamed of moving to a big city as an adult. A few times a year, I would travel from Virginia to New York to visit family, always in complete awe the first moment a skyscraper came into view. In college, I chose to study abroad in the teeming metropolis of London. I craved the thrilling nightlife, the bustling streets, the ethnic diversity, the thousands and thousands of available women. I wanted to go to museums and concerts and art house cinemas, and to drink in crowded, boisterous pubs. Urban life was the life for me, I had no doubt. All that would change in the fall of 2007, when at the age of 23, I went with a friend to see the movie Into the Wild. It's the true story of Chris McCandless, a kid from the same part of Virginia as me, who took off into the wilderness in search of a more meaningful life than our drab, contemporary consumerist society could offer. The movie had a profound effect on me, and the very next day I planned to climb up Old Rag Mountain, one of the most famous hikes on the East Coast. The trail spirals a few thousand feet of elevation in only a couple of miles. The last hour of the hike is entirely rock scramble and a bit dangerous. Being out in nature among the trees was invigorating. As my friend Logan and I reached the top, we rested on a rock, laid back, and looked at the clear blue sky and the rolling Appalachian Mountains. Eagles soared above our heads. I felt a serenity and euphoria that I had not experienced in all the great cities I had visited. On the way down, we were lost in conversation when we noticed a gargantuan pile of fresh feces in the middle of the trail. We wandered over to it, wondering what it might be, when we heard a rumbling in the bushes. Bear. When you come across a large animal capable of tearing you to shreds and having your liver for a snack, the first instinct of any normal person is to get the hell out of there. To my great surprise, my friend Logan grabbed his camera and took off towards the sounds of the thudding footsteps, rustling leaves, and growling noises. Not wanting to leave a friend alone to the whims of our omnivorous new acquaintance, I chased after Logan. We got within 20 feet or so and snapped a few photos. The bear looked at us, unfazed by our presence, and rumbled off deeper into the wilderness. The whole experience gave me such an adrenaline rush that I practically galloped the rest of the way down the mountain. That same night, I booked a flight to Hawaii, where my freshman college roommate lived as a surf instructor. I would spend a month there learning how to surf, jumping off cliffs, hiking through the tropical vegetation, and nearly drowning while freediving through underwater caves. It was as if a new world had opened up to me, a world that was at the same time far more relaxing and exciting than the life of the urban dweller I had fancied myself to be. A world that connected with some primal part of me, the world of Mother Nature. Compare how different the modern urban environment is to the one in which our ancestors lived. 50,000 years ago, you woke up in the morning, stepped out of your hut and rubbed your eyes, before taking in the sprawling view of the African savanna, the beaming sun, and the sounds of exotic birds. You grabbed your bucket and headed to the local freshwater stream for a drink, perhaps stopping along the way to pluck a tasty fruit off a tree branch. The hunter-gatherer is intimately familiar with the environment, sporting an encyclopedic knowledge of the local flora and fauna. To be effective hunters, men must learn the habits and patterns of hundreds of different species of animals. They learn to track the game by footprints, urine samples, and migration patterns. They become incredibly skilled at using their various handcrafted weapons such as bows and arrows, blow darts, and spears. For women, gathering food requires them to be knowledgeable about a wide swath of edible plant life, including roots, vegetables, tubers, seeds, nuts, and fruit. They have to know when foods are ripe, what season they grew in, where to find them, and how to extract them. Hunter-gatherers have to know how to make things from scratch, like a house. They have to be able to predict the weather, treat wounds, and start a fire using sticks in under 30 seconds. During my visit to the Amazon, I was awed by the Waurani's mastery of the jungle. As we hiked through the dense thicket, we would stop at what appeared to be just another tree. But then a Waurani would slice open a tree branch to reveal delicious, cool drinking water within. Minutes later, we gathered poison from the root of another tree to place on the darts the tribe uses for hunting. Next, they cut off a few vines and twirled them into rope to tie together a basket made of leaves from a nearby plant to carry all the items we collected. These guys were savants of the rainforest. Studies of nature. Psychologists have documented the numerous benefits of being surrounded by natural settings. A stroll through a natural setting, even if only for a few minutes, is relaxing, calms the mind, and allows one to replenish resources for attention. It lowers stress and improves one's mood. The Health Council of the Netherlands has found a positive link between living close to nature and human health. hospital patients with a window view are more likely to survive than patients without. Those living in urban environments without parks and trees nearby are more likely to suffer from ill health than those that live on greener boulevards. In one astonishing study, the simple act of placing potted plants in view of workers at a factory reduced sick leave by 40%. And it's not just our visual processes that are positively stimulated by nature. Our olfactory system inhales the phytochemicals released by plants. These aromas have an immensely positive effect on our mental and physical health by lowering stress hormones and reducing anxiety and pain, while increasing the effectiveness of our immune system. A study of Japanese businessmen who took a walk in the woods showed that the positive effects on their immune systems were still evident in tests done a month after their walk, and by a large amount. Evidence suggests that not getting out into nature enough can lead to problems with obesity, attention deficits, and depression. It is not just the lack of natural flora that hurts us. Being surrounded by the sounds of construction, traffic, honking horns, and the other cacophony of an urban environment has an additional negative effect on one's health and well-being. The scientific literature on the positive benefits of nature is vast, and I could go on and on, but I think you get the point. Fill your abode with plants, have a window facing a towering oak, and get lost in the woods. A sense of the divine. The Mabuti pygmies considered themselves the children of the forest being their mother. HGs are known for having a spiritual connection with the world around them. This can often lead to forms of animism, giving anthropomorphic qualities to the trees, the landscape, the sun and moon. I am certainly not advocating any kind of spiritism, but neither do I have to in order to install a sense of wonder in Mother Nature. Good old science will do. You are related to everything alive. You share a common ancestor not just with all other human beings, but with your pets, and even with a tree outside your window. Go back far enough, and all our grandest of parents were the same cells in the ocean. Stand in the forest, and all around you, from the towering trees to the ants crawling underneath your feet, are members of your extended family. Every second, you are inhaling oxygen that flows into your blood and keeps your heart pumping. You quench your thirst with water gathered from the raindrops, and it's water that makes up 60% of your body. When you eat other life, be it plants or animals, that life is transformed into the very composite that is your flesh and bones. You are not separate from Mother Nature. You are a part of it, from the air you breathe to the minerals in your toenails. Childhood freedom. You are sitting around a campfire with your family, telling stories, laughing, having a good old time when your cute little toddler takes a wide-eyed interest in those warm, bright, red and orange flames leaping out from the fire pit. Perhaps she is wondering, what is this thing that makes light? What would it be like to touch it? She begins to crawl forward, inching closer and closer to the burning embers. You watch her calmly. She stretches out her hand, and there is still time to intervene, to pull her away, to scold her for putting herself in danger. But you don't. You watch motionlessly as her delicate fingers singe. In HG culture, children are considered to have the same rights as anyone else, and those rights include not being told what to do, even by their parents, even when their safety is at stake. This is just one of many dramatic differences between childhood now and the childhood we had for millions of years. These differences begin the very moment we are born. An HG baby will be held to its mother's breast all day long. This was the norm long before we became Homo sapiens. All our primate cousins maintain close contact between mother and newborn. Monkey and ape mothers will carry their young on their backs until they are ready to jump around on their own. Human mothers don't walk on all fours, nor have a plethora of back hair, hopefully, for their offspring to cling to, So HG mothers will often wrap their babes in a blanket that they tie around their torso. A study of the Kung found that